Good afternoon. This is Penny Moore, and I'm the Senior Vice President of Program Development at the Center for Medical Technology Policy. It's my pleasure today to welcome you to the webcast sponsored by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality Effective Healthcare Program that's titled Community-Based Participatory Research, Lessons for Stakeholder Engagement in Patient-Centered Outcomes Research. We have a wonderful turnout today with over 260 people participating by phone. Just a brief word about our sponsorship for our webcast today. It was funded as part of the ARCS Community Forum project, for which I'm a subcontractor. The Community Forum is charged with working with ARCS Effective Healthcare Program components to expand stakeholder involvement in research processes and activities. And by stakeholder, we mean the broad array of groups with a vested interest in outcomes of comparative effectiveness research or patient-centered outcomes research, such as patients, clinicians, payers, policymakers, and healthcare administrators. They are also developing and testing methods for gathering public input on value-based healthcare questions. That said, the presentation and panel discussion that we're going to have today does not represent the official policy of either ARC or the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I also want to note today that we're recording the webcast, and it will be made available on ARC's website for your review for you to pass on to those who are not able to attend today. Before we begin, I'd like to set the stage for why we felt this was an important webcast to host. Community-based participatory research, or CBPR, has a rich history of community engagement that reaches back almost a half a century. Meanwhile, a fundamental feature of patient-centered outcomes research, or PCOR, which has only recently entered our lexicon, is the engagement of users of research in research in helping to select priorities, designing and implementing research, and translating and communicating the findings. Given that researchers involved in both fields interact infrequently, we thought it would be terrific to host a dialogue between experts in both fields to talk about some of the relevant lessons. So today we're hoping to bring together experts to discuss some of the lessons from CBPR and how can it enhance stakeholder engagement in PCOR, and to encourage a greater dialogue and resource sharing between the CBPR and PCOR research communities going forward. So I'm thrilled today to introduce our panelists. We have an absolutely expert and excellent panelist joining us today. Ms. Pat Vdoverka is a senior research director from the Center for Medical Technology Policy, and she has led CMTP's efforts to develop and test robust methods for involving stakeholders across a variety of PCOR applications and has published extensively in that area. She oversees CMTP's Patient and Consumer Advisory Committee, which provides ongoing advice about how to more effectively engage patients and consumers in CER, and they have contributed to the development of principles and stakeholder engagement in PCOR and a conceptual framework that she's going to be sharing today. Another of our PCOR experts is Dr. Dan Mullins. He's professor in the Pharmaceutical Health Services Research Department at the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy. His research has used aspects of both CBPR and PCOR. He is serving as the principal investigator for a PCORI contract to enhance methods for engaging hard-to-reach populations in PCOR and is a recipient of one of six NIH CER methods development grants examining ways to improve the efficiency of clinical trials. In addition to his research as PI, Daniel has been responsible for the evaluation of components of a number of community-based interventions for other PI's grants, including an NHLBI grant aimed at reducing hypertension among black males and a current State of Maryland grant to create a health enterprise zone in West Baltimore to reduce cardiovascular health and health disparities. Ms. Dwan Monroe brings a patient perspective to this dialogue. She is living with diabetes and hypertension both, and she's also a community outreach trainer and advocate and facilitates the Community Health Action Team in Baltimore. She has experience with CBPR directly with working with Johns Hopkins University in chronic disease management, and also has been a community advisor for Dr. Mullen's grant, which I mentioned previously for PCORI. Our experts in CBPR include Dr. Madeline Shalowitz, who is a director of health services research and section head for child and family health studies for North Shore Research Institute, which is an affiliate of North Shore University Health Systems, an integrated health system serving the Chicago area. She's an experienced health services researcher, specifically in reducing health disparities in pediatric and maternal health, and she also brings a perspective of working through North Shore's community health hospital community benefits program to improve public health in the community. She's also the lead author of an ARCS-funded review of the literature on strategies for community engagement with CBPR. Dr. Nina Wallerstein is professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine and director of the university's Center for Participatory Research and director of the Community Engagement and Research Component of the Clinical Translational Science Center. She has 25 years of CBPR research experience, and her work is focused on developing culturally centered research in tribal communities. So our agenda for today's webcast will be a little bit innovative and highly interactive. We are engaging people in a dialogue and have set this up as a conversation among the panelists. We're going to begin with a short didactic presentation from our CBPR experts, Dr. Nina Wallerstein and Dr. Shalowitz, giving us an idea about an overview of CBPR and its use in health system settings. And Dr. Pat DeBerke will provide an introduction to stakeholder engagement in PCOR. Next, we're going to move into an open dialogue across our panelists about the some of the similarities and dissimilarities between CBPR and stakeholder engagement in PCOR and some of the lessons that we might learn. We've reserved a portion of the webinar at the end to focus on the specific issue of how to engage underrepresented populations. And I'll be calling on two of our panelists, specifically Dr. Mullins and also Dr. Shalowitz, Dr. Wallerstein, to discuss the issue of how to engage underrepresented populations. And we will also be asking for Dwan to provide a patient perspective throughout, and we'll ask her to be a reactant through the different discussions that we will be having today. So I would like to point out also that there's a 15-minute Q&A period at the end of the webinar. If you could, we would like to make sure that this is interactive, and so if you could use the chat feature, you can type in and submit your questions as we go through this webinar, and then the webinar facilitator will share your question with the audience and ask the speakers to respond at the end. We'll do our best to respond to everyone, but our time is limited, and we'll follow up with any questions that we're unable to address after the webinar has concluded. Okay. All right, and so without further ado, I would like to, it's my pleasure to turn this over to Dr. Nina Wallerstein to provide you with an introduction to CBPR. Nina?
Thank you so much. I am asked to basically set the stage of the principles and framework for CBPR. So I want to start with the definition. As we all know, next slide, W.K. Kellogg Foundation CBPR definition has been highly used as a collaborative approach, equitably involving all partners, using and benefiting from community partner strengths, and starting with a research topic of importance to the community with the goal of improving community health and improving health equity as a key action orientation to this research process. It's based on looking at CBPR as part of a continuum of community engagement. Next slide. Often we do research which is on communities. If you can show the next slide, please. Often we do research that's on communities or sometimes in community settings and clinical practice settings, for example. But to move towards a CBPR perspective, we have to ask the question, how much are we involving our community members in a with perspective. How much are we working with community members, with community agencies, with community providers, rather than on them with our own determined agenda? CBPR has a set of principles that will be useful to looking at PCOR research, recognizing the community as a unit of identity, a long-term commitment approach, balancing research and action. In my own experience with tribal communities, I've recognized the importance of working under tribal sovereignty, where tribal governments have the authority to approve you being on the, to work with that community, and also to approve any kind of data that will be published. They own the data. And although most communities may not, most people on this telephone call or conference may not be actually working with tribal communities, these ethical principles of working with community members as colleagues and co-publishers and sharing those kind of data in a very genuine way, I think has applicability for all communities, these tribal principles. Next slide. I wanted to share with you today mostly this conceptual model that colleagues and I in a three-part partnership have been developing. It's a NIH study from the last, we're on our fourth year, that is a collegial partnership with ourselves at the University of New Mexico, the University of Washington, and the National Congress of American Indians Policy Research Center in developing this model that I think would be useful not just for CBPR, but for PCOR processes as well. And let me just walk you through it. It starts with the left side of, looks complicated, but it's very straightforward. We all live and do our research in a context, whether it's a socioeconomic context, a historic collaboration context of the relationship between the clinical setting, the health setting, and the university, or the community setting and the university, the capacity of the community, even the university capacity to engage in CBPR or community-engaged research. That context sets the stage for whatever partnership is developed, whether they're agency members involved, community members, CBOs, clinical providers, academics, and those partnering processes are both based on decision-making and relationships and how you work well together, the trust that evolves, but also the structure. What are the guidelines, the norms, the memorandums of agreement? The essence of this model is if you have community partnership of some sort, it will change and inform the research, which moves you to the next oval. It will change the intervention. It will change the understanding of how this fits within the culture and organizational context and climate. A lot of the implementation science agenda comes right in here of the context. And that change will then inform a set of outcomes that might be not just only improved research outcomes, but also greater capacity of the clinical setting or the community setting, policies that may improve health at a larger level, capacities, et cetera. So this model of engagement, we expect and hope, could be useful in thinking about PCOR. Let me just take you through a few more examples of how we've used this model to set up metrics and measures of partnering, asking the question of how do you know if you have an effective partnership that's going to make a change in your outcomes. So next slide. This, as I said, is a Research for Improved Health study. We've been testing the model. We've developed a literature review of existing measurement tools, but we developed our own instruments, bringing together the best skills we could of the country that we found and developed new ones to do a data collection of over close to 300 partnerships in an internet survey and some in-depth case studies. And I want to share with you just a few metrics and measures out of our research, and you will be able to get these access to these instruments, et cetera, through these websites when you get off this webinar. Next slide. So just some examples. We have examples of community capacity context. You can see the number is the number of questions within scales. We have found that through our beginning analysis of our data over the partnerships that we collected data from, that alignment with the principles, that if the partners are aligned with their values and principles, it actually has associated with better outcomes. Power dynamics, how much that's shared, the process of dialogue and listening, how much the partners involved in different aspects of the research, not just in the design and the research design or the questions, but in the data collection, in the data analysis, which of course you have different roles of partners, but most importantly, the data interpretation and the usefulness of this back to the community as well as to the clinical setting. And then, of course, trust is a major element of how partnerships work together. So those are some skills that should be available to you. Next slide. We also have found that if those partnership dynamics are working well, that there will be impact on set of proximal outcomes of partnership synergy and cultural centeredness of the work itself, as well as some more distal outcomes of improved personal and professional level outcomes of the partners themselves, and then concrete changes in community policy level outcomes, improved services, and health improvement. So we have measures as well as of these outcomes. Finally, I just want to give you two examples of what these very important measures mean. This is an example of cultural centeredness, which says, in this case, this is a billboard on the Navajo Nation, have you noticed a change in your harmony, breath, energy? It may be shows that you need cultural centeredness. This is not a billboard you would find in New York City. This could only be a billboard for the Navajo Nation, and that's for any of our interventions, how to think about what does it mean to be doing it within this context, this clinical context or even this community context. And finally, just a short showing you of our metrics of trust. We've developed a typology that goes from no trust up through what we call critical reflective trust, and we've been looking at how trust both can be nurtured and can grow within a partnership. And just to finish, these metrics we suggest and measures could be used with all members of a partnership to be able to assess how much they're in alignment with each other, what's the level of trust in this partnership now, where do you want to be in the future, and how, for example, can you get there, best get there. And given that trust, of course, we consider an important partnership dynamic for then reaching the kind of outcome that might be important, not just in a community setting, but again, through PCORE in clinical settings as well. So with that, I'll end and look forward to the dialogue. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Nina. And I think that it's specifically great that you have these links to resources that are embedded in your slides so that participants will be able to go back on to the ARC website and find this material. I'd like to move now to Madeline Shalowitz, who's going to be talking about her specific experience working within an integrated health system and using community CBPR. Thank you. Madeline? Hello? Madeline?
Oops, sorry. You were on mute. The purpose of this transition is to move from the community setting to a healthcare setting and harness community wisdom in a somewhat different way to the academic rigor of the medical environment. And in that regard, I'd like to acknowledge my academic partner and affiliation in this, which is the University of Chicago, because the CTSA at the University of Chicago has been really supportive of the work that I'm going to be showing you. And the health services research background that I bring to this is now being applied in the Center for Clinical and Research Informatics at North Shore. The next slide, please. So what Nina presented to you is a very balanced view of community and researchers. But really, in a health system, the balance is very different. The health system is very concerned about its patients and also about those who pay the bills, the payers. But family and cultural and society is rarely, if ever, considered in traditional medicine meaning the U.S. healthcare system, not tribal medicine. And perhaps will need to be incorporated more as we look to more integration of health outcomes across sites and services. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. But I do want to point out to you that more in line with Nina's presentation is that the perspective of the patient, or I'm a pediatrician, so you're seeing the perspective of the parent with regards to the child, is really about their lives outside the treatment setting, and you'll see that the health system is located at the periphery of their life. So whereas the health system sees itself at the center, to the family, their lives outside the treatment setting is primary. Next slide. So the program I would like to describe to you is Be Well Lake County, which is North Shore University Health System's signature community benefit program. It is a direct donation from the hospital and various other funders to the Lake County Health Department, and it provides comprehensive diabetes management for adult medically underserved type 2 diabetics in one of the northern counties of Illinois. It's a partnership between North Shore University Health System and the Lake County Health Department, which operates 5 community health centers in Lake County. Next slide. The purpose of presenting this to you is to show how patient input and provider input has changed the clinical programs that are provided and also changed the questions we ask in the evaluation. So the clinical program was, in fact, a collaborative development among North Shore Community Health Department service provider input and data in an iterative process over time. What North Shore brought to the table was funding for comprehensive primary care visits, medication and testing supply assistance. Because community health centers have so much difficulty with subspecialty care access, the North Shore physicians were provided subspecialty care to the health center patients as part of the proposal. And thirdly, medical nutrition therapy and diabetes education. Is my sound coming through okay? Because I now have a big echo. I'll assume it's okay. And with patient input, though, which I'll show you in a little bit more about in a minute, over time and through philanthropic funding, we've added fitness programs, a community garden, and retinal screenings. Next slide. One of the concerns of the community is that this diabetes program is housed in a food desert. And so based on provider and patient input, we added a food security measure to the standard care. And what we learned was almost 57% of the patients with type 2 diabetes in Lake County, in fact, did not have adequate access to food. So we asked the question, do patients who don't have enough food have worse diabetes control? Because that certainly makes a lot of sense since diabetes involves substantial lifestyle management. Next slide. I'm showing this to you as a pilot data analysis because I think it's really important to understand that medical care is in a larger context, and in fact the community context may influence the outcomes of Cadillac care. So in fact this program brought all of these resources to families and essentially eliminated most of the access issues. At the beginning of the program, the patients had pretty similar hemoglobin A1Cs, but by 9 months in the program, you can see a diverging difference between those who are food secure and those who are food insecure. Insecure is the top curve, and secure is the bottom curve. So in essence, those who had food security, who had adequate access, profited from the program, whereas those who were food insecure were not able to do that. The interference with glucose control increased over time. The next slide. So I wanted to present to you a way to bring together all the stakeholders in this environment. And the top part of the slide shows you an organizational structure that I've in fact used and I'm still using with the Lake County Health Department partners in order to run a CBPR program. And then I'd like to talk to you about the adaptation to PCOR. You'll see that all of the stakeholders interrelate to one another through two advisory committees. The balance of the advisory committees is different. On one side, the community, but that has representation from the academic side, and then an academic steering committee with representation from community. So in essence, we operate as a complex network so that we make sure that all voices are heard all the time, even though the specific agendas might be different. I propose to you that a sample PCOR adaptation might look quite similar, where the health system and patients are the primary stakeholders in the center, but that we bring in payers and policymakers, family and communities into a funding and service provision side and then a community advisory committee in a network model similarly. Mm-hmm. In summary, I think the adaptations for healthcare are clear for CBPR, although the overlap is not completely 100%. And with that, I'd like to turn back to Penny.
Great. Thank you very much, Madeline. I just wanted to remind people that we are going to be sending out the slides for today's presentation. We've been getting a lot of questions about that at the conclusion of the webinar. So you will be getting that, everybody who's registered. And without further ado, I'd like to turn this over to Pat to give us her presentation on PCOR in stakeholder engagement.
Thanks, Penny. My task today is to briefly describe the role of stakeholder engagement in patient-centered outcomes research, which admittedly has a much shorter track record than CBPR, but I believe shares some of its objectives. Next slide, please. First, I'd like to ensure that we're all clear about the relationship between comparative effectiveness research, which I refer to on several of my slides and in the reference materials, and patient-centered outcomes research, or PCOR, the focus of today's webinar. On the left-hand side of the slide is a familiar Institute of Medicine definition of comparative effectiveness research, or CER, which is uniquely characterized from other types of clinical research by its purpose, which is to provide comparative evidence to help stakeholders make better decisions. On the right-hand side of the slide is a more detailed description of patient-centered outcomes research, or PCOR. PCOR, I think, can be viewed as a subset of CER, or more specifically, PCOR is comparative effectiveness research focused on and guided by the needs and concerns of patients. Just like CER, PCOR requires the active involvement of stakeholders to ensure that the research will meet its stated goals. As you can see from the bullets that I've listed, patients and other key stakeholders should be actively engaged throughout the research process, which includes the results dissemination phase, an aspect of the research continuum that has traditionally been neglected after scientific publication, but is an area of intense research currently. Next slide, please. I think it's important to highlight the context for involving stakeholders in PCOR. There was a great deal of initial enthusiasm, I think, for stakeholder engagement that was supercharged in 2009 with the $1.1 million ARRA funding for CER. These stakeholder engagement efforts were focused primarily in the areas of priority setting and identifying future research needs, but there are also some examples of involving stakeholders in designing studies. In parallel, a number of researchers, including our team at CMTP, took a step back and evaluated what was working well with the process and what were some of the barriers, which I've listed here. Many of these may sound familiar to you, and many of these have begun to be systematically addressed by experts in the field, but briefly, the literature has lacked consistent terminology and definitions for stakeholders and lacked consistency in processes for stakeholder engagement. There also is no shared understanding between stakeholders and researchers of what it means to effectively or successfully involve stakeholders in research, primarily stemming from a lack of common principles and best practices, but more fundamentally because there is no agreed-upon conceptual model for stakeholder engagement in CER. Perhaps not surprisingly, there's limited data regarding the impact of involving stakeholders in research, and systematic evaluation of the process, such as we saw described by Nina, is rare. Researchers have an expectation that they often need stakeholder input in projects with short timelines or immediate start dates, and it's difficult to coordinate schedules with all relevant stakeholders. There are also extensive training needs for all of the stakeholder groups, and I would put researchers in that category, and so need to ensure full participation and a meaningful experience for stakeholder engagement, which I'm going to define later. All of these issues translate into concerns, primarily on the part of researchers and funders, that stakeholder engagement will add time and cost to projects. And without clear measures of impact and effectiveness, I'd argue that there's no good way to put these concerns into the proper perspective to assess the true value of stakeholder engagement. That's why our group of researchers at CMTP undertook an effort to help address some of these barriers, as you'll see on the next slide. There's a lot of information here, and if you're interested in understanding these concepts in greater detail, I provided a reference to the article that goes into the full background and development of the definitions and conceptual model. In the interest of time, I'd like to highlight just a few key points. First, given the identified problem of confusing terminology, we worked with an advisory group of patients, consumers, and patient advocates to define what we mean by the term stakeholder. I'd only point out here that our definition includes the notion of communities, so there appears to be overlap with the target audience for CBPR. Then after reviewing the literature on deliberative methods and other approaches for engaging stakeholders in research, we took the step of defining what we mean by stakeholder engagement. And you can see that definition on the lower left-hand side of the slide. Here I'd like to emphasize that after extensive discussion and debate with our advisors and project team, we settled on specifying two key aspects of the process. First, that it actively solicits knowledge, experience, judgment, and values of the people that participate. Therefore, we really wanted to signal that each of these sources of information are seen as valuable and desirable for the process. Second, that it's focused on two important outcomes that ideally require collaboration to achieve: creating a shared understanding among stakeholders and making decisions that are viewed as actionable and credible to all parties. Again, there seems to be overlap with the goals of CBPR, although the differences between them appear to occur in how the methods for engaging stakeholders are translated into practice. Finally, I want to point out that we also recognize the need for a conceptual model for engaging stakeholders so that we could begin to measure the impact at both the level of process outcomes and final or CER outcomes. This model is adapted from the literature on risk-based decision-making that use both analytic methods and deliberative methods to inform choices, solve problems, and make stakeholder-driven decisions. We felt it was highly relevant to the situation of CER, where research experts and non-experts come together to use data, experience, and values combined through a variety of quantitative and qualitative methods to make decisions that ultimately are translated into both immediate project-related outcomes or more long-term health and policy-related outcomes. You'll see in some of the process outcomes notions such as trust, respect, fairness, which appear comparable to some of the concepts covered by Nina. While successfully applied to one three-year project, this model requires further testing on a broader range of projects and requires the robust validation of the sort that Nina shared during her remarks. Nevertheless, we feel that agreement regarding the definitions, terminology, and conceptualization of stakeholder involvement is essential for understanding the contributions of stakeholders to CER and evaluating the effectiveness of engagement practices. Only then can we measure and evaluate the influence of stakeholders on particular CER projects and use these results to inform process improvements and conceptual model refinements. The next slide provides a graphical depiction of how we currently see stakeholder engagement occurring in practice. While this slide was developed as part of a white paper commissioned by PCORI to describe the international experience with methods for engaging the public in topic generation for research, it's useful for describing the continuum of patient or stakeholder engagement in research as well. At the top of the slide is the traditional approach to clinical research, where patient representatives are occasionally invited to meetings or asked for input. Here, the information flow is primarily from the researchers to the patients. At the level of consultation, the information flow is primarily from the patients to the researchers in the form of focus groups or questionnaires or even mediated conversations. But typically, patients don't participate in decision-making, and the goal is not to have the process result in new shared understanding of the issue on the part of both the patients and the researcher. I call this stakeholder engagement light, as there are certainly valid methods for involving patients in the research process through this type of engagement. However, it does not reflect the type of interaction described in our definition. The third level describes true collaboration, where the information flow is intended to be bidirectional, and this type of interaction would occur as part of an ongoing relationship where trust would be built over time. Under these circumstances, shared understanding and effective decision-making would be the result of this true partnership. The highest level of patient involvement indicates that patients actually drive the research agenda, and projects and researchers only participate on the request of the patients. These types of studies are more common in the UK, but may become more prevalent over time in the US, given recent funding announcements from PCORI for patient-powered research networks. So let me stop there, and I'll turn it back over to Penny.
Thank you very much, Pat. That was a lot of great information. At this point in time, what I'd like to do is to open this up for a little bit of reflection about the similarities and differences between CBPR and PCOR. And I'd like to specifically call on Madeline, if you could reflect a little bit on your thinking about this question. How are they different and how are they similar?
For me, the CBPR value system, the goal of equalizing power across the stakeholders and including patients in a bidirectional dialogue is very similar in both. It really becomes an issue of how to define community, and one can use any definition around a particular illness or a particular interest in illness in terms of family support. There are many ways that you can define a community, but CBPR has traditionally done that outside a treatment setting. PCOR up until this point seems to be using mostly within the treatment setting as the area of interest. The other thing I wanted to comment on is the timeline associated with CBPR. And typically, the NIH has tried to invest in these kinds of proposals, but they are always surprised about how long it takes to develop the partnerships, to mature the products that come out, and then to assure sustainability. PCOR is operating on a 3-year agenda, and it will be very difficult for them to adhere to CBPR in a classical sense.
Madeline, I've actually, in a discussion with you earlier, you had mentioned, which I thought was very interesting, a sort of, and I think this was bound up in your definition that you talked about, being inside of the treatment setting versus outside of the treatment setting, but also being more sort of medical-centric, that PCOR is much more medical-centric, and I'm wondering if you could just comment a little bit on that.
Well, that's in fact true. The calls for proposals are usually centering on disease diagnoses and how to augment the outcomes and the experience for patients and families in that regard. CBPR really is looking more at the health of the community and how the health of the community can be improved overall through lifestyle or interventions that might include medical interventions but also lifestyle interventions. More typically, the PCOR focus has been medicine and about medical problems specifically.
Okay. I'd like to also ask Pat the same question. And Pat, you put together a very nice slide that we're going to put in the background here. If you could just talk a little bit about your perspective about the similarities and differences.
Sure, Penny. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sort of a graphical person, sort of thinking pictures. And, you know, I was trying to, as I put the talk together, think more about the similarities. And you wouldn't necessarily think about it in sort of this Venn diagram because it looks like there's not much overlap. But maybe I'll start with the commonalities first. So I certainly think that improved health outcomes at the level of communities, you know, and Madeline talked about sort of the emphasis on a public health mission versus maybe treating a medical condition, improved health outcomes are at different levels, but certainly that's in common. And clearly engaging the participation of individuals outside the traditional scientific paradigm, that's in common. And in PCOR, the focus on patients and caregivers and clinicians is clearly the focus, but I think who we say represents the community in CBPR, you know, there could be a bigger dialogue about that, and Nina talked about that. But I think clearly the broader concept of participation outside of the traditional scientific paradigm is clear. And something that I think that CBPR is clearly more advanced, and Nina alluded to this, but I think it's certainly the intention of PCOR is to have this participation be characterized by mutual respect and trust that's something that's built up over time. And I was really intrigued about sort of all the different dimensions of trust that Nina described in her last slide. And we try to do measures of that, and would be very interested in seeing whether that scale that she mentioned could be something that we measure as part of stakeholder engagement. So I think those at that level, there's certainly commonalities. But what I try to put on this slide is I do think you have to think, at least at this point in time, the goals are different. We heard Madeline talk about that. And I do think that in terms of how the research is designed, and maybe it's a function of the 3-year funding cycle, but right now a lot of the interactions tend to be on the PCOR side, more on the consultation side. I think they are trying to move more toward collaboration and having these partnerships be sustained over time, but they tend to be more consultative, like for brief periods. And I think in some ways, it's how one measures the outcomes. I feel like in PCOR, it's defining the problem as a lack of evidence. And if we had better evidence, people would make more informed decisions. And I feel like the outcomes are more global on the CBPR side. And, of course, improved health outcomes informed by better evidence is certainly a piece of it. But this transforming social and economic conditions and changing the system and the capacity of the system from a public health perspective is a much broader agenda. Now, I did put a little bit of that in there because I do feel like for PCOR, particularly with some of the recent funding announcements for things like patient-powered research networks, I think there is an interest in shifting the research agenda and changing the capacity of the system to respond to the research priorities of patients and caregivers. But I think that's something that's at a very nascent stage. So hopefully this picture sort of allows us to sort of think through that and to have people challenge whether they agree with my conceptualization.
That's great. Nina actually has asked to raise a point here. So, Nina, if you would like to do that.
So I actually think that it relates to the purpose of research that you are thinking about. All of this could fall. So, you know, with ACA expecting much more patient engagement or a growing field, I think the opportunity and the potential for PCOR and CBPR to actually share this they're doing is pretty wonderful in that with what you're saying, Pat, of the patient-powered research networks. But the purpose, the research, to me, is the driving force. If the purpose is to really create a shared, be in the context of a shared leadership, you are then looking at, as you said, Pat, broader outcomes of not just the specific screening or medical uptake of that kind of medication or whatever the specific is, but you're also looking at patients and communities taking control of their own health. And you may not do it in a one-time cycle of a PCOR grant of 3 years, but as a clinic, you're geographically, you're a health system geographically situated within communities. And if you're making a commitment to that community over the 20-year, 40-year, 100-year lifetime of that community when you think your health system is going to be there, then the possibility for really changing that, not just adapting or implementing a single, you know, gaining the expertise to know that this works with patients, but you're building a much bigger purpose of community engagement and community capacity as an outcome in and of itself as being critical for the health of the whole community. So if it just depends, and then you can build a PCOR grant upon another PCOR grant upon another PCOR grant with a bigger perspective of building this partnership or even community-driven idea and the continuum that you presented where the patients are driving it. Just like in CBPR, we have community-driven research or community, you know, tribally driven research. That's mm-hmm. even stronger than just shared leadership. The possibility of thinking over that 100-year lifetime of health system's commitment to a community matters, not just the specific grant itself. So if we really are thinking of a larger purpose of outcomes, then each grant will enable, hopefully, to build that incrementally. Then it does matter what process you use.
Thank you very much, Nina. I'd like to actually go back to Dewan right now, and specifically as you've talked about this importance of from the patient's perspective. Dewan, could you just reflect a little bit on what you've heard here, and then we'll go to Madeline, who's also asked to contribute to this.
Okay, no problem. Thank you. From a perspective of a person had as a patient, but also as a person who has done some work in CBPR and also focus groups, working with community outreach workers and working in the community and listening to patients and clinical settings, particularly also with research, a lot of what is happening here with the similarities is that the piece on trust, creating a rapport, being genuine, frequent contact, being transparent and upfront is the essential piece around either CBPR or PCOR. So a lot of times I've noticed, and I'm sorry, my phone is beeping. A lot of times I've noticed with studies that they don't take the time to really measure and see how important trust is. So I appreciate having that trust scale up. And also looking at the fact that sometimes it looks like that PCOR to me could be like a pre-pilot for a CBPR study when you take some small clinical context and then you want to make it into a bigger, broader type of health outcome.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, Madeline, if you had something that you wanted to raise.
Well, I wanted to react to Pat's comment that there is no evidence. I think that both PCOR and CBPR are saying that there would be evidence if we asked better questions. And, in fact, the way to ask better questions is to rely on
on experts, but the expert is not necessarily the health provider, because in essence medical care happens within a 15, 20, or half an hour visit, but health happens outside the treatment setting. And I know I've said that more than once now, but the patient needs to be understood by the provider as well as being an expert in how a treatment plan will happen in their daily lives.
So do you have any suggestions for asking better questions, or what specifically do you mean by that?
Well, asking better questions, PCOR is looking to incorporate things like preserving employment, being able to care for children, being able to function on a day-to-day basis as better questions to ask than just, will I live longer? That's the way they are thinking about the better questions. CBPR really extends that much further into family and community in ways that PCOR will likely think about over the course of time, but right now is really focused more on the immediate impact of the disease.
And so before we turn to our next question, I'd like to ask Daniel if he has anything to add. Daniel Mullins?
Yes, I would echo. I thought that Pat's diagram was very nice and showed some of the differences, and I thought that Nina's presentation was terrific at talking about bidirectional learning. In my mind, I think if we could use what we know works in CBPR, but apply it to health-related questions that help patients and their care providers make better decisions, that's the win-win. I don't think that we want to suggest that everything that we've learned from CBPR is enough. Clearly, we've learned how to do CBPR for other types of questions, and my guess is that the methods will need to be enhanced in order to apply them to PCOR. So I would draw upon the experiences from community-based participatory research, but recognize that we will need to adapt them as we apply them to important patient-centered outcomes research questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Daniel. I actually think that what I'd like to do is ask this question about whether or not there are enough similarities between CBPR to allow us to draw some lessons from PCOR. And it sounds to me like the consensus among you is that there are enough similarities to be able to build on this as a platform. So I think actually let's go on to the next question, which I think will be building more deeply into what are the strategies for effectively equalizing the power structure between researchers and other stakeholders that allow for shared decision making. So anyone, just feel free to speak up on this particular question.
Well, this is Nina. I think this is probably one of the essential questions, so appreciate that you are asking it, or we are asking it to kind of, and I think a lot of, there's no cookbook on this kind of answer. There's really only an intention to make it happen and to build the kind of relationships with partners so that this can be talked about, because one of the critical strategies is actually recognizing the power differentials. You cannot equalize power unless you recognize that people are coming from different positions of power. Patients don't necessarily consider that they have power and maybe don't in cases of extreme need, but certainly all of us as patients can demand power from within our own relationships with the clinical provider. But in addition, we're talking power at setting the research agenda. That's a different kind of question than power in your own medical treatment. So the power to set a research question is hard to do as individuals, and that's why you want to work with community organizations, associations, clinical groups of support groups of patients as a group where people are not doing it on their own. So two things I would suggest as strategies. One is to recognize that there are power differentials as a starting point, and how do you raise the question? The second is to look at both. In our model, we have this idea that it's not just the relationships that you work on and building trust, but it's also in the structures that you set up. And as Madeline so nicely put in the structures of her research question, establishing community advisory boards that have real authority behind them, or establishing community, whatever. We started calling our community advisory committees in tribes, we started calling them tribal research teams, so that they are actually co-researchers with us. They're not just advisory committees. And so that TRT idea, tribal research team, how do you create these colleagues within community partnerships of patient groups or community organizations, or even with the clinical providers as partners as well? So you might need to build in memorandums of agreement and how do you, guidelines for data sharing and ownership and guidelines for publication. You have to build in the structures of participation, not just the good relationships. So I think those, to me, are important.
That's really excellent advice, Nina. Dewan actually had a question or wanted to contribute here.
Yes, just something really quick that sounds really, may not sound major, but listening to other patients, where you have your community advisory meetings where you announce your recruitment for people to be a part of the actual research process plays a key role when you're looking at power structures. A lot of times we're asking people to come to the university, come to the institution, come to where we are. So we in public health want to do more of practicing what we preach and meeting people where they are. So having not just one or two, and not just disseminating information at a community event, but involving the process within the community, so utilizing the community recreation centers, faith-based organizations who want to be a part of the process, and conducting these processes, these meetings, and these recruitments in the community, along with the community, and how they bring people as a part of participating in particular community events and participating through that. So not just saying, you know, you need to come here, pay our parking, be a part of what we're doing here, to actually start, continue, and even end with being already in the community.
That's great. And Pat, you had some thoughts about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there are many different strategies, and like what Nina says, it has to be, the strategies have to be targeted to the objectives, and depending on whether you're setting a research agenda or developing a specific research protocol, or it all needs to be tailored. But things that we've tried in the past and we're learning as we go, but clearly defining the roles of all of the stakeholders is very important up front, managing expectations, having a neutral facilitator. So many times if it's the researcher that's running the meeting, it's very difficult to equalize power structure. So having a third party or a neutral facilitator can be very important. Having a lot of training and spending additional time with different non-experts to prepare them for the meetings, because I think there's a sense that if you don't feel like you have mastery over the concepts, that you can't fully engage in the discussion and dialogue. And I've certainly heard from researchers that don't feel like people that are not researchers can participate, for example, in protocol design discussions. But I think we've debunked that belief by simply, you know, spending adequate time preparing all stakeholders for participation in those meetings, and that could be payer participants or policymaker participants as well as patient participants. I think measuring at various time points in the project stakeholder attitudes about the process is very important, and recalibrating the process based on the feedback that you get from those evaluations is very important. And then we've done things like, I think Nina mentioned co-publication. I think an evaluation of the process and co-publishing with stakeholders is very important to demonstrate that their involvement was meaningful in a comparable power structure with the researchers. So those are just some top-of-mind strategies. And again, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all, you know, approach to the problem.
Okay. Madeline, I think you had some thoughts.
Right. I just wanted to acknowledge that the goal of this is not to make patients – providers and researchers or any in the opposite direction. The goal is to identify people for their strengths and work from strength to strength to identify synergies. And in the meantime, each person needs to be a good consumer of the other's information. So in writing a paper, just as an example, it's unlikely that a community person will be writing the statistical section. But you would hope that by working together over the course of time that the community has a solid sense of what it means to use numbers in statistics and what those numbers mean. But on the other hand, if the academic strength is in the methodological rigor, the community strength is in framing the problem and interpreting the results in a way that the person who understands methodology can't do without about moving into the community role. And so you create a network of interactions that's greater than the sum of the individual parts. The other thing I wanted to bring up is the need for absolute accountability in the trust-building process. And that's, I would say that at least in the beginning, because of all of the fear of researchers, academics, doctors, all of that, is initially that responsibility is on that side to show that you really are listening, because the tradition is not to listen, to be very responsive to everything that you've heard. And when you promise something, you do it. It's just like a mother and a child. You develop trust over the course of years, and then the child grows up and maybe actually is going to teach the parent. But it happens with many, many interactions over the course of time that demonstrate the respect that we have for one another.
Okay. I am cognizant of the time that we have here, and we have actually three more major questions that we had talked about discussing. What I'd like to move on to is the question about successful dissemination strategies. So if we could reflect on what are some of the successful dissemination strategies for bringing the results back to the community, and then we will move on to the looking at engaging the underrepresented populations. So I guess what I'd like to do is, speaking of dissemination strategies, potentially start off with Nina's perspectives here about CBPR and what kind of lessons we could learn.
Well, I guess to me this is part of a dialogue that we have with our partners. So the question is, what would be most useful to the community is the first question that always emerges. So we often think in terms of dissemination is as an academic exercise of peer-reviewed journals and all of that. And this question, that the way it's framed, is not that. It's basically saying, what is the benefit to the community as a key outcome? And unfortunately, our IRB often just looks at individual cost-benefit, harm-benefit issues and not the idea of community benefit. And just, for example, when you go to the Navajo Nation Institutional Review Board, there is a requirement from that IRB that you have to write as an investigator how you are going to provide training and technical assistance back to the community as part of even getting your IRB to be approved. So that builds in dissemination immediately back to the community. And so the question is, what's the right context within that community? In Peace Corps, I don't know, are there patient newsletters? In community, there's often community newsletters, tribal newsletters. Are there? We do executive summary reports. We do what we call community voices reports. We do meetings. We invite people back who've actually been interviewed or surveyed into a community meeting. But the question of which one you choose, to me, it needs to be asked to the shared group or the community advisory board what to them would be most important for actually getting messages out, and what are the various forms that can be used, you know, in terms of social media, et cetera. So I think that it's not that there are specific strategies, but that the decision-making of how those strategies are decided comes with that idea of the partnership together in this bidirectional approach of decision-making. So those are some of the thoughts of how we've thought of it.
That's great. Also, I'd like to ask Daniel, you had some thoughts on this.
Yes, I agree with what's been said so far. Certainly, we know that producing lay summaries is incredibly important. The traditional approach of having a manuscript that gets sent out and then we hope that somehow that gets disseminated is not a very good strategy. So having lay summaries, creating those in partnership, as Nina said, using some individuals from the community through an iterative approach to make sure that the phrasing is culturally appropriate, recognizing that there's a need to bring information back to those who participated in the study, as well as the communities from which they come. So there are two stakeholders there. There's the individual, and then there's the community. And also, it's important to know communities. A lot of my work has been in minority populations, but I think that some of this would generalize to all people. And that is that sometimes people don't want to know just the results of your study. They want to know information about how the study is going. They want to know, are they the only person or only group that's participated? They want to know if target enrollment is being met. Sometimes it's equally important to celebrate the successful completion of a project, and the community wants to celebrate, not just learn what happened, because they participated in something that actually was completed. I think many community members know that some studies don't enroll enough patients and end up terminating, and no information really emerges from that study. And that's very frustrating when you have volunteered to participate and then there are no results. So providing that type of feedback, I think, is equally important to having lay summaries when a study does report out.
Okay, great. And Dewan and Madeline have also asked to contribute, and I would like you to keep it a little bit short so we can move on to the next session, but maybe we can start with Dewan.
Okay, I just wanted to add what Dr. Mullins was saying as far as the celebration. I participated in a clinical research study with hypertension in black men, and we actually did a celebration with their families, and the actual PI and researchers were involved along with the community to disseminate the findings in a culturally appropriate manner. But also we had an opportunity to have the actual participants in the study talk about their experiences to the audience, to the community that came to be a part of it. So the piece about the celebration and understanding what are the next steps. I went through 5 years of participating in the study. How is it going to affect my children? How is it going to affect my community in the long run? They want to see what's really going to happen with this besides papers and a lot of what they participated in and what was brought in through the study. Is that going to continue or is it going to stop because the study stops? They want to know, is there some sustainability, some continuity in what really happened in the study and what's really going to be the next step?
Okay, and Madeline?
I just wanted to speak for a moment. Certainly everything that's been said thus far is critical, but I wanted to add the element of timeliness, particularly relevant for health research, and particularly when we're looking for patient perspectives and we may be identifying depression or anxiety or crises in the home. It's very scary for a participant to be asked questions oftentimes, and without and sharing that information often has some personal cost. We absolutely have to, as researchers, feed information back to the families in terms of resources, and I know that this goes against pristine study design, but it's irresponsible in my point of view to leave that information in a file for a manuscript that's going to get written several years later. If we're doing things, let's say, for diabetes and we're identifying people with high hemoglobin A1Cs, that can't sit in a data file until the end of the study. That has to be brought back to the participant in real time with a connection to resources.
That's really terrific advice. I'd like to move on now to engaging underrepresented populations and specifically the question about what are some of the essential lessons for engaging underrepresented populations in CVPR that would be applicable to PCOR. And I thought, actually, we'd just kind of flip this a little bit and start with our PCOR expert, Dan Mullins, who's been focusing a lot on hard-to-reach populations within the Baltimore area. And, Dan, maybe you could just say a few words about your thoughts on this.
Sure. I'll begin by saying that one of the major reasons that patient-centered outcomes research really has come forth as an innovative breakthrough in the way in which we conduct health sciences research is because it answers questions that are important to patients. And we haven't done that well in the past. We haven't answered questions that are important to patients. And that's all patients, but it's particularly true in underrepresented populations. The challenge that researchers face is really flipping research on its head so that we engage a diversity of patients up front. We oftentimes think about dissemination. We don't think about upfront engaging individuals. Historically, we conduct research, even comparative effectiveness research, and then we try to translate it. But we never stop to ask the question up front about whether our question is really an important question to the patient. We think it's important. We think it's fundable, but we don't bother to ask if it's important or meaningful to patients. Last year, JAMA had a CER theme issue, and we published a paper on this in which we talked about the fact that patients really need to be engaged at all 10 steps of research, and particularly in comparative effectiveness research. The first three steps in our framework are, number one is topic solicitation, number two is prioritization of those topics, and number three is framing that research question. Many of us would acknowledge that these are important. All of us on the phone would probably say, yes, we should be doing that. And the reality is that we don't always do that. We sometimes skip those steps because, as Pat said before, we're in a hurry, we've got to get this done. Or we do acknowledge and we say, well, you know, the Institute of Medicine did those first two steps. They talked about topic solicitation and prioritization. So maybe we don't have to do that. But those are national priorities, and local priorities may be different. So I believe that we need to do each of those steps, and we really need to do step number three, which is, even if we know what we're going to study, we need to figure out how to frame that question from a patient standpoint. Many of the folks on the call today have some type of professional degree, and in most professional schools, we train students in what we call the teach-back method. The teach-back method is that, you know, a clinician explains to a patient some aspect of their disease or some aspect of their treatment, and then the clinician asks the patient to repeat back in the patient's own words, you know, what is your understanding of your disease? How is it that you understand that you're supposed to take your medicine, or how is it you're supposed to follow the treatment regimen? Well, why don't we have a similar teach-back method for framing research questions? Why don't we explain what we want to do and ask the patients to teach back to us what that question is? I think that that will help us to produce better research. It has a side benefit of also being ethical, in the sense that we are supposed to have informed consent. And how do we know if a patient is really informed if they don't really understand the question? So I believe there's a lot of benefits here. I want to follow up on what some of the other speakers have said. The biggest challenge that we face in underrepresented populations is this issue of trust. It comes up first, it comes up last, it comes up every 5 seconds in any of these discussions. And we need to establish trust with the community as well as with the individuals who might participate. Another challenge is what's been referenced before, too, is this issue of transparency. I heard a very nice example of this in some of our work in which some of the patients said, researchers never tell us what they get out of this. And I thought that was interesting. That, you know, do you guys get a raise if you complete the project? Do you get promoted? And they understand that there are incentives for researchers to do research, and they want to know a little bit more about that, because that might help them to understand whether they trust this research process. You know, if a physician's getting $500 per patient to recruit patients, that might make a difference in whether the patient wants to participate. As Penny alluded to at the beginning, we did some work funded by PCORI that specifically looked at two types of what was termed hard-to-reach patients. The first were minority patients, and the second were patients with some type of impairment, whether that was visual, hearing, mobility, or cognitively impaired individuals. And we heard loud and clear that there are some ways to address these challenges. We've heard some of them: partnering with community organizations, partnering with community leaders, being there. If you want to establish trust, you're not just supposed to come at the kickoff meeting and maybe at the end, but being there not just throughout the study, but that you're going to be there afterwards. And that if you're going to come back in 2 years for another study, we hope that we don't just see you 2 years from now. We want to see you at a community event. Come to where we live, come to where we work, come to where we worship or where we hang out. it's well documented in the CBPR literature that hair salons and barbershops are a good place to meet African Americans if you're trying to recruit, laundromats for many people, where people receive social services, the community health clinics. In an urban environment, we learned very loud and clear that in West Baltimore, every neighborhood has what they refer to as the mayor of the block. And it's not hard to find out who he or she is. That person oftentimes, you know, is similar to a pastor in a church. They kind of run the show in there, and they can help you to find patients who would be interested in your study. We talk about media. We talk about social media, online forums. We oftentimes don't think about cultural-specific media, like narrow reach media. A lot of minorities have a specific TV station or a specific radio that may be very local, but it's where they listen to get information. A lot of people with low SES ride the bus, and having information at the bus. I think that the major fast food chains get that. Every time I stand by the bus stop, I see an ad for a fast food chain, and so obviously they're getting the attention of people. Maybe we need to meet people, you know, while they're in transit. We need to engage at two levels. I think we oftentimes think about engaging with the individual, but first we need to engage with the community. First we need to have a sense and to explain and to discuss with the community what it would mean to partner to do patient-centered outcomes research. Learn what they want out of the partnership. You know, I think we don't oftentimes ask the partner, what is it that you want to gain from this experience? We need to answer difficult questions like, who's responsible for this? When we talk about getting patients, who's recruiting the patient? Who's doing the follow-up care? You know, simple things. If we're providing food, who's buying the food? Is that coming out of my budget or is that coming out of your budget? Those are important questions to address with communities. How are we going to give back and how frequently and how often? And then after that, we can begin to have conversations between the partnership and the patient. Sometimes when we're trying to recruit somebody into a study, we go up to Mr. or Mrs. Jones and we say, I'd like to describe a study that we're conducting and see if you'd be interested in participating. We expect that Mr. or Mrs. Jones will listen to us and then say yes or no. Well, the reality is that the Jones family probably wants to go home and discuss this. And so it's not surprising that people who enroll in studies drop out. It's not surprising that sometimes the data that we get is not, you know, honest, because it's true that there are some patients who show up for the $20 gift card. And so we need to understand that if we're not addressing this need for trust, we may be getting people enrolled, but are we really getting meaningful data? So one alternative is something that we've learned from the Safety Net Hospital. And the research nurse there, she approaches Mr. and Mrs. Jones in a different way. And she says, I'd like to tell you about a study that we're conducting. And when you come back to clinic next week, I'd like to talk with you about whether you're interested in participating. You know, her recruitment is much higher because she gives them the time and she builds that trust that she's not trying to rush a decision. So we need to really understand kind of what's of interest to patients. I'm going to close with a great anecdote. One of the visually impaired patients who participated in our PCORI contract, he said, you know, I often get asked to participate in vision studies, but I have never been asked about enrolling in a diabetes study. He said, I've been blind since birth, so I'm okay, and I know how to manage that. But my diabetes, that's a problem. I'll end with that and take any questions later on.
That's a great anecdote, Daniel. Nina, I think this issue of building trust is something you've worked with for a long time, and specifically your work in the tribal communities. Could you give me your thoughts about engaging underrepresented populations in CBPR and its lessons for PCORI, thanks.
Yeah, I actually have two kind of different ways of thinking about it. The first is to reframe the question, not how can we better engage those folks in our studies is almost how it is stands as a question, but more from, let's start from the university's how we are viewed first. You know, we come from a long trajectory of building a lot of mistrust in communities in the way that there's been research abuse in communities. So we need to do our job better as university people and university structures to reframe our way of doing business so that people trust us for a reason, not trust us just because we're requesting them to trust us. So I often look at, you know, what's our university policy? Are we doing better at recognizing
the way to involve communities. You know, are pilot grants, for example, do they provide incentives for people to childcare, food, travel, all those kind of things that enable a university to actually have the capacity to do this kind of work? And I think that's a really important difference, is looking at our own selves first and saying, how can we do better in terms of being worthy of trust? So I think that, for me, is a really an important way of thinking and building and developing partnerships and relationships and to kind of turn the tables. The other is to think very genuinely about what a lot of people have said already, which is the importance of being respectful, being bidirectional, being reciprocal in our approach. And, you know, Pat said very early on that in stakeholder engagement, if knowledge is really seen as being equally valued by the community, other people have said this, Dwan, Madeline, everybody has been saying that, how do we value the knowledge from patients, Dan, the knowledge from patients as being equally important. And the way we tend to think about it as sometimes we think there's evidence from the community, from the academics, and then there's community belief systems. So just by using these different terms, evidence from the academic and community belief systems, we kind of create a hierarchy. So how do you transform that so that we look at that there's evidence from all different stakeholders? There's community evidence, there's practice-based evidence, there's cultural-based evidence, there's patient-based evidence of what works for them, and how do we create and link that in positive ways to the university evidence that comes from other research design and other research studies that we've built up in our own literature? And I think if we begin to transform these hierarchies of power so that our community partners genuinely believe that they are respected and honored, and that they're, you know, if we're working with a community association or community agency that's helping in recruitment, that they are able to vouch for us for a because of our action, that they are, you know, we often go to gatekeeper associations or places, or whether they're barbershops or wherever we're going, those become gatekeeper places, but they need to vouch for us for a reason. And so I really try and think about how are we creating these mutual partnered relationships that people can vouch for us in good faith. And so the trust is built on our actions in good faith, that we're showing that our university is being responsive, our university IRB is responsive, our university funding is responsive, all of that to the demands and needs of community partners when they help us set up research projects. And lastly, I do think that we have to look at the range of stakeholders, you know, that we're working with, and include also policy stakeholders and leaders, whether they're and like faith-based ministers, all of those folks are really important allies for establishing partnered research projects that, again, can help us in bringing community members to the table. So I guess I want to end with one statement that I've kept in my mind ever since that Mary Northridge published it. She's the editor of the American Journal of Public Health, that she published this very early on, an editorial about community-based research, and she said the three things you need to do are listen, listen, and listen again. That's only one of them, but it's the listening as key. The second thing is show up, which is what Dwan so eloquently talked about early on in this webinar, and others have just mentioned this over and over, showing up outside our own walls, and then believe and push for and work toward social justice. And again, that really means mutual reciprocal respect. So, and transforming, you know, structures that are not, that are inequitable. So I think that those three things I keep in the back of my mind as a way to engage I don't tend to think of people in populations. I tend to think of people as community members, as family members. So it's hard for me even to use this language of population, because I think our language is very much influences the way we think. And if we're trying to think of mutual respect, then you think of community members or family members. That also is a way to really begin to turn the tables on who's telling who what to do.
Thank you very much. We have cut into our time for questions a little bit, but I would like to ask Dwan if you have just a couple of thoughts before we turn to questions, just a few points.
Yes.
I really appreciate the opportunity of being on a panel with researchers who get it. Because being a patient, but also being a person who has done clinical research studies as an interventionist in the community and working on advisory boards and supporting community health workers, which is also a caveat I'll get to in a second, I appreciate the fact that community people don't have to really kind of explain being a part of the process and then being invited for a webinar that really listens to researchers who actually really have heard what communities are saying. And also, I see the fact that if you have both people in either CBPR or PCORI, everybody comes with a different perspective, but it's always that personal feel. To me, PCORI feels a personal person's personal feeling when it comes to dealing with an individual health issue. How am I going to manage this? How is my family going to manage this? And you have people that are clearly just focused on that in the community, but you also have people who not just focus on that, but who also are focused on how this globally looks to my community and how it's going to happen in the future. So both, I think, need to continue to really bounce off each other and play a key role in partnering with each other as they move forward in getting more research and more studies and understanding how to really play this out. But everybody has also mentioned and said the things that I'm constantly saying. To me, the key is trust, continue to build genuine trust, to have appropriately culturally knowledge training out there, so that patients can really come in with a better understanding, and making sure that once things are disseminated, and that's a community-driven process, that there are some next steps, there are some tools, there's something tangible that they can either put their hands on or that they can take back to another physician, or when they go to participate in another study, that they can continue that knowledge base.
Great. Thank you, Dawn. That's a really nice conclusion for the webinar. I'd like to turn it over now to Nora to facilitate some of the questions that we've gotten from participants on the phone.
Thanks, Penny. And we've gotten some really good questions. The first one here I think I'll target towards Nina. The question is, can any of the CBPR experts elaborate on what is meant by the community as a unit of identity? Nina, can you speak to that?
Well, I guess it's a very hard question because there are so many communities, but there's geographic communities, there's community. When I think of communities, I think of communities that have shared identity. If people come together as diabetics, or if they come together as lesbian, gay, transgender folks, if they come together as members of a church, if they come together as a geographic community, it is a challenge for clinics situated in geographic communities. People may not come together around their own geography, but we all live in multiple communities. Providers are communities. So it is, again, a question of how, it's often a question of if you're doing research with a community, that community will be defined in that way at the time. Communities are fluid and they're dynamic, and we live in multiple communities, all of us.
Great, thank you. And I would also like to invite any of the other speakers at any time, just use the raise hand function if you'd like to chime in on any of these questions. The next one is specifically for Madeline, and the participant asks, what are the benefits and costs of having two separate advisory groups, community and professional, versus one multi-stakeholder group, and why do you choose two separate groups?
It's agenda driven more than anything else, and there are issues that the community is less interested in than the academics may be less interested in or more interested in. I think it's very important to maintain, for example, the relationship with the NIH, for example, or with PCORI or with ARC. In the details, the production of a progress report or just the administrative tasks is not as much of interest to community members. And so I'm thinking of examples off the top of my head. For community, how to make sure that the resources associated with any question that you ask, which I told you I feel very strongly about earlier, but to make sure that the mental health resources for example, for somebody who might be in crisis are in fact up to date and don't have a waiting list. I just think that things naturally separate. They could separate in other ways too, but that's the ones that a priori seem to work better. But the knowledge from one to the other remains important, and that's why we have membership of each and both.
Thank you very much. The next question is also directed to our CBPR experts. It says, since it does take such a long time to develop a CBPR partnership, should there be small grants available to prime the pump and help potential applicants develop the partnerships and CBPR research questions in the first place before expecting such a partnership to grow organically without such support? So, Madeline, Nina, would either one of you like to respond?
I would say yes, and in fact, I've been lucky enough with the communities of Lake County to have been able to begin that way. But there is also the question of sustainability after the grant is over, and to be able to continue the good work and the interaction that's begun even after the grant ends. So I would add that small grants at the end for that purpose are also important.
I would just guess too, and seed grants often in university settings provide that, and it would be great if NIH also had these small pilot grants to build partnerships, as a policy change for NIH would be highly useful, and even within the PCORI structure as well.
Thank you. So the next question we have is, how are PCORI and CBPR different or the same as participatory action research?
I mean, there's so many names for this kind of participatory research, and they came from different places. Participatory action research is this often used in education and in some of the social sciences. It is the same. I mean, there's participatory research coming out of Latin America and Africa and Asia. There's different historical legacies that we come from. There's action research. It's used more in England and in Australia. But there's also different emphases, what history it comes from, whether it's more kind of an organizational change, action reflection cycle. So I think you could say it's the same, but you should look at the intention and purpose of the research as kind of that's where often these similar participatory processes differ. It's not so much the name, but in the overall purpose and where they fit on that continuum of involvement.
Thank you. We have, I think, just time for maybe one more question. And, Daniel, I think this is a good one for you. The question is, health information literacy should be discussed. Institutions and academia speak with terms that most do not understand, and this increases the divide with communities. Can you respond to that?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that there's a variety of levels. There's basic literacy, and then there's health literacy. So I really like the question, and I think that we need to address both. We have some people who maybe really do understand their disease and how to manage it, but they may have low literacy skills, and so then we need to make sure that information that's new gets put to them in a way that they can read. We have other people who maybe can, you know, read quite well, but if they don't really understand a disease, that providing them with information about treatment, they may not be health literate. And so we do need to make sure that we do that. Again, I think working with people from the community, having materials be developed in an iterative process with patient engagement, with healthcare provider engagement, will help to address that. And I think we also want to think not just about those issues, but translation into other languages, large print for elderly patients or individuals with visual impairment, all of those issues are critical to make sure that we're able to engage the most diverse population in our research.
Great. Just one more slide. We're out of time. And so I'd like to, with that, I would like to thank everyone for your participation and thank very much to the panelists for this excellent conversation. And please join, if you could, we will be looking on, we'll be sending out the links for the
the slides, as well as sending out a link to everybody for an evaluation that we would like you to fill out. The webinar will be available on the ARC website, and we recommend, if you want to pass on this information to your friends and colleagues to access this webinar, that it will be there in approximately a month's time. So thank you so much, and we hope you learned something today.